Well, why don't we take our seats and Yeah, I should have had that. I wrote this about 8 in the morning. Maybe we could distribute that agenda just around the desk here.
Yes, I think it's just... Okay, thank you. I'm going to have to remove that.
Okay, go ahead.
Cosmetic, if that might go.
Yeah, yeah, there's one. Take it. I've got an extra.
Do you have a pen? God, I don't know what the hell I did. Thanks.
I got a ball pen, too.
No, this will do. This will do.
Okay. You, how about yours? Do you have one?
Yeah, fine. Fine. Well, maybe I could call our gathering to order. My name's Tom Berger, and I want to welcome all of you here today. Let me say at the outset that this roundtable is sponsored jointly by the Alaska Native Review Commission and the Alaska Humanities Forum, and I want to thank the Humanities Forum for the assistance and support that it has provided throughout the work of the Alaska Native Review Commission. Perhaps you would allow me just to say a few words by way of an opening statement, and then perhaps I might make some suggestions about our agenda, and then we can introduce ourselves. I've been traveling around the state since the beginning of the year, and we've held hearings in 46 villages and towns, and more than 900 Alaska Natives have testified at those hearings. And it is apparent that they are apprehensive about 1991, and virtually all of them, even the great majority of urban Natives, wish to see Native ancestral lands remain in Native hands to be passed on from generation to generation, and they want children born since 1971 to participate fully in the settlement. Well, I think we all have gotten that message, and I don't see any point in dwelling on it, but let me turn to some of the questions in my mind, and hope that perhaps we can consider them over the next 3 days. If there are no changes in ANCSA, What is likely to happen after 1991? Everybody's worried about 1991, but what is really likely to happen then? Will the native corporations be the target of takeover bids? By whom? Will shareholders sell, and if they do sell, to whom? Are the 1980 amendments relating to a family and corporate right of first refusal likely to be effective? Are the 1980 amendments relating to the restriction of voting rights likely to be effective? And what about the land bank provisions of ANILCA? Is this an effective way of immunizing subsistence lands from taxation? Then there's the question that people keep bringing up. They say, well, you keep talking about 1991, but they say, will the corporations, all of them, survive until 1991? Is there a possibility of corporate failures before 1991? And even if changes are made in ANCSA, will there be a possibility of corporate failures after 1991? And are corporate failures likely to be as the route by which native lands are lost, quite apart from takeovers and the possibility of taxation of native lands 20 years after conveyance? Well, the AFN has at its recent convention advanced a series of resolutions for considerations by its membership. Other proposals have been made in other quarters, and I hope that we will be able to take a look at them. We have people here from regional corporations and from village corporations. We have economists and legal experts. I know all of you have been thinking about 1991 and the issues it raises. Among others that I think should be addressed are these, and I mention these because there are many questions that come up, but these might be overlooked otherwise. Given the desire expressed in many villages to unite under village ownership the surface and subsurface estate of village lands, do the proposals to transfer ANCSA lands or ANCSA shares to IRAs, non-profit corporations, or other entities meet this concern? Can it be met? Perhaps not, I don't know. But I can tell you that in most villages I've been to, there's a definite feeling that the surface and subsurface estate should be united under village ownership. That's something that I hope is not overlooked in discussion. Wherever I've been, everybody seems to agree that the acquisition by outsiders, by people from New York or Tokyo or Seattle or, God forbid, Anchorage, the acquisition by outsiders of control of native corporations and native lands would be a bad thing. But perhaps you'd be willing to address the question, what about the possibility of acquisition by a very few native people of control of native corporations and native lands? Would that be a bad thing? In 1971, Congress conferred ownership of the shares in ANCSA corporations on Alaska Natives then alive. Should any options regarding the future be determined solely by the present body of shareholders with voting rights? It has always seemed to me a kind of a conundrum that Congress said in 1971, well, we'll give all the people who are alive shares in these corporations and they will control native ancestral lands through their shareholdings. There's a widespread feeling that that was a mistake, yet proposals to find a way out of that dilemma rest on obtaining the consent of a majority of those very same people, those who have shares and who are entitled to vote those shares. Well, there are many other questions that I'm sure you wish to raise, but those are some that have been on my mind. Maybe we could just introduce ourselves and then take a look at the agenda that I've proposed. Let me start by saying my name's Tom Berger, and I have been retained by the Inuit Circumpolar Conference and the World Council of Indigenous People to conduct this review of ANCSA. Everybody knows that, I think so. But moving to the right.
My name is David Case. I'm attorney in private practice. I'm also counsel to the Alaska Native Review Commission.
I'm Paul Goodwin. I'm the Subsistence and Natural Resource Director at Rural CAP and also a special assistant to the Commissioner of Education on Rural and Native Education.
I'm Bart Garber. I'm an attorney presently teaching at the University of Alaska. I'm from Tyonek, living in Anchorage.
My name is Elizabeth Johnston. I'm Vice President and General Counsel for Bristol Bay Native Corporation, a regional corporation.
I'm Chris McNeil, Tlingit Nishka. I'm Vice President and General Counsel of Sea Alaska Corporation.
I'm Paul Loudenslager, Professor of Political Science, Western State College, Colorado.
I'm Roland Shanks. I'm Land Manager with Clutton Incorporated.
I'm Marlene Johnson from Sea Alaska Corporation, Vice Chairman.
My name is Gary Anders. I'm an Associate Professor of Economics and Finance at the University of Alaska, Juneau.
I'm Jack Taylor, an Associate Professor of Management, University of Alaska, Fairbanks.
My name is Tony Strong. I'm a private attorney. I live in Clockwan and have a practice in Juneau.
I'm Drew Hageman. I'm an Assistant Professor of Business Administration at the University of Alaska at Fairbanks.
I'm Charlie Johnson. I'm Chairman of AFN and President of Bering Straits. I'm not a professor or an attorney.
I'm Monroe Price, and I'm Dean of Benjamin N. Cardozo Law School in New York, and I've worked with Cook Inlet Region over the last decade on problems related to the Native Claims Settlement Act.
I'm one of a long line of Johnsons in this group. I'm Ralph Johnson, a law school professor at the University of Washington, teaching Indian law.
I'm Claude Domenoff. I'm the executive director of Kotlatsan Unlimited, a consolidation of four villages on the Kaikuk River. That's Huslia, Hughes, Alakakit, and Alatna.
Well, thank you. We're recording everything that's said on tape, and it'll be typed up, and there'll be a transcript. So when you speak, if you don't mind grabbing the nearest mic and speaking into it, just as I'm doing now, that will make the work of taping the proceedings easier. And they are being videotaped, so if you have your card facing outward, it means that the camera will pick up your name on the card as well as your face. The agenda that we just put together is just tentative and was designed as simply a way of getting the ball rolling. And you'll see that we already, thankfully, have gotten past the first item, opening remarks, introductions. In a moment, I'll ask Bart Garber to make a presentation. We asked him to prepare a short paper in advance, and he will be discussing that. Then we thought we would have some general discussion, and I asked Monroe Price if he would participate in that to help it to give us his views. And Nelson Angapak, who can only be here today, he is president of Chilista. Well, he said he could only be here today, and so far it seems uncertain that he can be here even today. So we'll just... I put some names down, but this is purely arbitrary, and feel free to speak up at any time. This is just a way of giving some limited structure to what we are doing. Then this afternoon, I was going to suggest we look at the question, the outlook after 1991. What will happen if there are no changes in ANCSA? Will people sell? What is the value of shares? That's a question that could keep us here forever, but let's just pass. Let's deal with it as in a brief way. How adequate are the 1980 amendments? And I thought we might ask, among others, John Taylor, Paul Goodwin, Drew Hageman, and Gary Anders to tackle some of those questions. But then on Thursday, I thought that we might take the liberty of looking at the AFN resolutions and that we would ask Charlie Johnson, Roy Hundorf, Chris McNeil, and Glenn Fredericks and Claude Dementiev to address those. But once again, I hope everybody will feel free to talk about these things. And if you have any suggestions about the agenda, feel free to make them. And at breaks in the proceedings, if you have suggestions about the agenda, please feel free to mention them to David Case or to me or to Rosita Worrell, who's also working with us at the commission, but is a little late this morning. On Thursday afternoon, we thought we might ask the people representing the villages to talk a little bit about the way they see 1991. And I put down the names of Dale Stotts, Dolly Garza, Rosemary Maher, Roland Shanks, and Tony Strong. On Friday, I thought we might look at that I mentioned in my opening statement a minute ago, and other issues, of course, that you might wish to discuss. And to discuss those questions, I put down the names of everybody whose name begins, whose name is Johnson. I thought that was a good spot for them. And Daniel Fessler is coming. He is a lawyer from California who's advising the state statutory revision commission on its corporate laws. And I think Bart is on that too, and Elizabeth Johnson. And Mr. Fessler, I believe, is coming on Thursday. Glenn Fredericks is coming Thursday. Dolly Garza is coming Thursday. Roy Hundorf is coming Thursday. So we will have those people joining us tomorrow. And then Friday afternoon, I thought we might discuss generally Native corporations, Native values, and Native lands. So that's just a way of starting us off, and we expect that as the discussion takes shape, we might make important changes in the agenda. So with those qualifications, maybe with your permission, I might suggest to Bart Garber that he start us off by giving us his presentation.
In my class, I get to work off my tension by walking all around. I just as soon be able to stand, but I'll get this through it sitting down. I know you haven't had much time to take a look at the paper I've written. It is it's a beginning. I'll be actually expanding it come February, and I have footnotes that are available probably tomorrow that still have to be typed up. So if you're curious as to where I get some references, you'll have that soon. You'll also notice when you read through that you don't see very many references to proposed resolutions or proposed amendments. As a native myself, and as a person who personally has to walk through the decision in 1991, I thought that it was important to look at that mechanism, look at that value that's in conflict. Those sections in the papers from the attorneys that was left out, it was left to the clients, rightfully so. And I think that it's a significant issue in 1991. Also, though, I am an attorney, so there is some analysis that has to come through. I found it very helpful to look through in history, both legislative history and just a general history, to look back what exactly was intended. So you'll see in the paper that we'll go through and see the formation of this 20-year limitation, those specific provisions that start and give the substance to the 1991 provision. I don't have to go over that very much in here because most people will know it, but just briefly. The 1991 provision began with regard to two different things. A restriction on the period on the alienation of stock until 1991. And secondly, there was a restriction on the taxability of undeveloped lands until 1991. As you know, both of those provisions are now subject to some amendment in that the taxation issue has been extended so that it's 20 years from the time of conveyance. And with regard to the alienation of the stock, there are some options now available where regions are able to, and corporations are able to have a buyback provision, or family members can also have a first right of refusal. And there's also the possibility of extending the period of time that non-natives are unable to vote. The purpose of those restrictions on their face is to maintain the control and ownership over the corporations and their assets. What I did in the paper, though, is to look back and see what it was that, why was a 20-year provision first put in? What were the aspirations of the natives at the time that they were first proposing a land settlement? And why was it a corporation that came up? And why was it that when there was a corporation adopted, that there was a necessity for this 20-year provision? To let you know where we're going to get at the end of this brief discussion, I think that the 20-year provision and really represents the battleground or the period in transition, and it's specifically stated as one, from a background of communal land holdings, of a, if you will, a communal property memory. Even those of us who've lived in the cities are more familiar with the idea and the concept of private property. There's a transition, a clear transition that was intended for the 20 years. There's different reasons that were piled on top, but ultimately what you would have is a transition from a communal holding where people aren't able to alienate their interests into finally a situation where individuals have real property rights in stock that they're able to sell. There's a conflict there, and it's given rise to these new 1991 issues. The new natives issue, the elders issue, the issue of whether you even want to allow the alienation of stock. I submit that what these are really that inner conflict, that conflict between this communal memory and land, or that idea that you want to have this community property versus the ultimate effect of ANCSA, if it does come about, and that is the absolute vesting of a private property rights system. Any other person who owns shares in a corporation, if it happens to be another company, isn't concerned, typically, unless they're a majority shareholder, who buys or sells or who has an interest in the stock. That kind of concern only comes about because you have a greater interest in land. The land and the assets of the corporation have a deeper value. Later in this paper and later in this discussion, we'll look at some of those specific differences between rights of tribal members and communal property, or rights of communal members, whether they're tribe or not. We have similarities in even the private property system, versus the kinds of rights, private property rights, that are given to shareholders in the form of corporate laws. There are some differences, and there are some unique rights that shareholders have that sometimes don't exactly reflect themselves in private property law, but the core idea is there. I'd just like to start with going back and what I've at least dug up, and many of the people here may actually have attended some of these meetings, to find out what was the purpose behind the 20-year provision, and what was the 20-year period of restriction, and what was initially proposed. At least in the written record, the first reference you can find is at the Alaska Task Force report in January of 1968. The task force was put together by the state, although the governor appointed certain members. The Alaska Federation of Natives participated, and the Secretary of Interior at that time appointed a delegate also to participate. They came up with a Senate Bill 2906. The purpose of the meeting is Willie Hensley at the time was the chairman. The purpose of the meeting was to try to find some common ground that the state and the federal government and the natives could agree to on a system of settling the land claims. You have to put their efforts, though, in the backdrop of history. And that was that the natives who were going to this meeting came with an experience with the federal government that wasn't all that rosy. It's granted the federal government did put lots of money into the community, attempted to try to, particularly in the 60s, put in different kinds of programs to help and assist natives. On the economic side, however, the natives had the impression that federal oversight had not been that helpful, that the businesses that the federal government did help them manage never made money, that the kind of management system that was available in the federal government was too encumbering. So they came in there with a view against federal oversight. What you have coming out of the task force, which as far as I could tell was only working 2 or 3 months on their proposal, was surprisingly and very close to what finally comes out in 1971, at least in the basic components. The natives want land, they want money, and they want to control it. There's an initial proposal to have regional corporations and village corporations. Villages are to have the option of being able to use Indian Reorganization Act councils as their means of receiving lands and money under the settlement. The period of restriction is brought in. The corporations are to be state business corporations. So on their face, stock would normally be alienable. However, the period of restriction at that time for the stock alienation was 100 years. And it's the only time in the legislative history anyway that I've been able to find some fairly straightforward explanation for that provision. Later on in the House bills and Senate bills, and as you get into the Congress, there's very honestly no discussion of the reason for that period of restriction. It's skirted. The issue is skirted. It's only at the very beginnings, and you'll probably wonder, well, why do you look at those provisions back then in '68 so with so much vigor? Part of it is that we want to find out what it was that the natives and what we wanted and the natives who were working then wanted to get out of a settlement before all of the contact with the Congress, before all of the negotiations and positioning. What was it that they wanted out of the settlement and how did they want to accomplish it? That's why I've harped as much as I can on the early history to find out what it was that they wanted when they went in. Because as you find out, and as most of us are familiar with, natives got fairly adept at politics after that point, so that there are a number of issues that they used to their advantage to finally obtain a land settlement. Yes, some of the alliances had something to do with it, but as much it was the use of policy statements by their alleged opposition, using the ideas that the other people believed in and could rationalize. And I talk specifically on this point about Nixon and his idea of self-determination and the present policy of the federal government with self-determination. The natives at that time pick that up and really run with it. There is the idea of wanting to be able to decide their own destiny even in 1968, and that is reflected in their reluctance to go with the federal government. The federal government's system of management was simply too encumbering. They didn't allow the natives at the time to fully participate in their own businesses or in their own activities. So you've got a 100-year provision that it starts out as. Barry Jackson and others specifically stated what the purpose of that provision was. And if you look at some of the other provisions in that Senate Bill 2906, the task force proposal, you can see that the 100 years was intended to be a transitional period. The specific statement said that it would allow times for tribal groups to ultimately learn to become regular business corporations. Now, that's changed some. We've seen that there are separate identities, and we've found that these native corporations, the business corporations, have their own identity, as do the tribal groups. So that idea of assimilating tribes, of getting the tribal groups as tribes to change into business corporations, at least on that side, it doesn't continue. But there still was that idea that it would take 100 years of being able to learn and educate and become accustomed with a private property system, with a system of business corporations under state law, that it would take 100 years to be able to do that. It also, and this is kind of interesting, addressed some of the problems that we're currently having with new natives. You can see that if there's a period of restriction of 100 years, there's much less concern that the children will ultimately become shareholders. 100 years is usually a sufficient period of time for at least two generations to go by. So that the inheritance provision is strengthened when you have a longer period of restriction. So there isn't the idea that you need to rush and get new people to have stock when you only have 20 years that you can be certain that you will have the stock to give them. So in that way, the early provisions, they weren't so much concerned with younger children. As a matter of fact, they specifically set out in the history there how the stock would go from generation to generation in talking in terms of a 100-year provision. As in the viewpoint of a lawyer and one who deals with the corporation laws of the state, the early bill was also interesting. They had the foresight even at that time to know that it might be necessary for the state to revise its corporate laws to deal with unique aspects of these native corporations, so that there was a specific provision there that stated, and the state was a negotiator here, that the state laws would be flexible with regard to these corporations and that they would take into account that this 100 years, this transition period, would probably bring various kinds of problems where the natives and their new corporations would not be able to survive under the laws of the state as they were set out for normal business corporations. They didn't say what provisions had to be changed, but they did recognize that there might be that problem. Even at this early point, the third major provision that the AFN at that point wanted was control over these corporations. Thus, you did have that idea that the 100-year provision would allow for education and also the maintenance of that control. With a 100-year provision, there wasn't very much discussion about the extension of that. There was the assumption that these corporations at the end of the 100 years would be normal business corporations without any need for special protections. However, that idea of destiny, of being able to confirm your own destiny, continues, and it gains strength through the late 60s and early 70s. There's some significance there because even now, some of the focus on being able to maintain control over the corporations is also this idea of natives being able to determine their own destiny. My question to you is, who makes the decision? Under the current resolutions, we say that shareholders do, and that the actions that are necessary to be taken are majority of a quorum. that tells me that as little as 15% of the natives who are shareholders will make decisions about the destiny of natives and the land that they own. Given the fact that the number of natives will double, that 15% is then reduced to 5 to 6% of the natives who live, who could essentially make the decision about what happens with land. I don't know if anyone will pick up on the idea, but self-determination policy does under ANCSCA is something different, and that's the next major focus in the paper. From what the federal government thought self-determination policy is and what self-determination policy as a pure concept is. Self-determination in its purest form, Vine Deloria has said, is absolute tribal autonomy and economic self-sufficiency without the support of the federal government. It's a people being able to determine on their own, under the conditions that they set, what they want to do. My question is does that kind of policy, does self-determination policy, does it have anything to do with what we're doing now? Or are we just working with a bunch of technical little problems that you're going to pay people like me and other people to deal with? Or is there something else? Is there a larger philosophy that can be used to guide the actions that we're going to be taking over the next few years in guiding us to some kind of solution, individually or otherwise, to 1991? The analysis that comes out in self-determination policy is that self-determination under ANCSCA is not true self-determination. First of all, we're restricted in our choices by federal law and by state law. There are certain inherent limitations that the general population as a whole has to live with. I concede that. But there are special provisions that restrict us under the federal law, and there are special provisions under the state law that arise from primarily the state corporate statutes that restrict the full scope of choices that are available to us in reaching solutions to 1991. We found it necessary to constantly approach Congress to get their approval for changes because we need specific authorization from Congress to change the restrictions that come up in ANCSCA. Likewise, under state law, we will have to go to the state or indirectly go to the federal government to get them to order the state to reduce the restrictions that arise in state law. Some of these specifically come about because under state law, we'll start with state law, come from the rights that shareholders have in corporations. We can see the most significant one that affects us is this right to vote and the right to dissent. David, in his new book, has essentially contended that this dissenting right may actually preclude, and it may be the most significant reason why it's necessary to eliminate it in the 20 years, that under a dissenter's right is if there's a substantial or an extraordinary conveyance of corporate assets, and we'll take a specific example. If we want, for instance, to implement an option for a village corporation or a region for that matter to convey their assets over to an alternative entity, we require a vote of the shareholders. If we didn't eliminate dissenters' rights, if they object and if it is deemed to be a substantial portion of the corporate assets, the dissenters usually has the right to have his stock purchased back. Well, under the 1991 formula, we can't purchase stock until 1991. So unless there's a change in the state statutes, if that person has dissenter's rights and if we can't buy the stock back, the natural assumption is that the court is probably going to say you can't make those kinds of significant changes without some special authorization from the Congress, or if the state wants to go out on a limb and make that kind of change, then you're going to have to get special authorization. So there, in the specific instances, how the state corporate laws restrict the choices that we have available to us. The federal law has many specific provisions that restrict us. I mean, the obvious ones are the 20-year alienation period. Now, that goes both ways. I don't come from either one side or the other as far as the political spectrum goes. If stock is, you have a 20-year provision there where many people wish didn't exist even now. They want to be able to sell stock now. So it's a restriction for them. For others, it's deemed a restriction from the opposite side, and that is they fear the idea that stock will be sold in 20 years. The thing that's common with both, though, is that the choices are restricted. This really isn't self-determination by natives. We have too many other people involved. And now that goes back from the very first task force reports and bills that were drawn up, where natives, from the very beginning in acquiring a land settlement, had to appease other parties till the very end in the 70s when we have to appease environmental interests, so that the choice is never truly and solely ours about what to do. Now, the other aspect about self-determination. I've said that that true self-determination, at least in Vine Deloria's view, is absolute tribal autonomy as well as the idea of economic self-sufficiency. ANCSA is, and self-determination policy under the federal law really emphasizes, because of the kinds of contacts the federal government has had with tribal people, emphasizes the first component, the tribal autonomy component, and mixes in the economic self-sufficiency component, because they are working with tribal groups all the time. Communal tribal groups. In the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, we have a unique situation where we have given at least in Kuwait rights to shareholders to have individual rights. They are not bound by the norms and customs and traditions of tribal law in the operations of their state corporations. They are bound by state and federal laws. So ANCSA, in my view, is a different kind of self-determination. It's self-determination of the individual native or corporations. It doesn't look toward self-determination of the tribe. The tribe has no part in ANCSA. The tribe has no oversight provisions, has no ability to affect the decisions of the corporation. Now you say tribe, what is that? I say tribe as a corporate body of people who are in the ANCSA corporations. Certainly you can go to the definitions section in ANCSA, and it says that a village holds land on behalf of a tribe, and a tribe is defined, or a tribe is one of the subcomponents of who it is that's a village, who it is that they have either a band, a village, or a number of other things. And a village corporation in specific is supposed to hold on behalf of that village. Tribe, in my view, is this larger communal, this corporate interest, where there is an interest that's separate from even the individual members. This is made clear when you look at the kind of rights that individual natives have in a communal system to property. They don't have the right to be able to alienate that property on their own. If they don't have that right, and they don't have the right also to manage that property on their own, it's managed by the governing body of a tribe, and the governing body is the only one that's left to make a decision with what happens to that land. To at least try to bring it up out of the philosophical, we see some of this, some of the purists on both sides fighting right now, so that you have the tribal groups, the United Tribes, who are working, and you have the AFN and the corporations who have a corporate viewpoint. They're fighting at that level. We see that there definitely is a larger communal body, a corporate body of tribal interests in traditional lands, and it doesn't have a way to express itself in ANCSA. Tribes are not corporate shareholders. They have no special provision in ANCSA that says that they are able to comment on what a corporation does. Instead, the only people who have the rights are individual shareholders. But individual shareholders don't, in and of themselves, speak for a tribe. A tribe, by definition, has a body of its own, and it has its own viewpoint. And it limits even its own members. Now, it's easy to get confused because there are some commonalities between a tribal body and a corporate body. They hold derivative rights to property. For instance, shareholders don't own the assets in a corporation. They only have the right to vote. They do have the right to the assets ultimately if there's a liquidation or if there's a distribution of those assets, as does a tribal member. If a tribe liquidates, there are special federal laws, and if a tribe, I suppose, ever traditionally liquidated, they might also have a right to a portion of those assets, but it would have to be under tribal law. Otherwise, they do hold a derivative title. The tribe is the one who